Session number 27813, it's Jack Ray, Real Free. Now, we're talking about victory claims, and one thing you've mentioned is that your Y service were reporting that you were underclaiming. Now, I know this whole thing's complex because some people think you were overclaimed, not you, but that there are more. What is this? I mean, did you hear that? Tell us what the Y service said.
Well, we understood from that the Y service would report back, because that the aircraft the one we got was that there were far more Luftwaffe and Italian aircraft being shot down than we were claiming, and we couldn't quite figure that out. But on the other hand, they said, look, just change your thing. If you fired at it and you saw it going down in flames, you're quite okay to make claims to destroy it. And our boys all said, no way. If we can't get a confirmation of it, we're not going to claim any different. And we stuck to that right through. And yet I read after the war, and I read in the books of chaps investigating, where even there the inference was that even what we were claiming, that according to the German records or the Italian records, we hadn't shot them down at all. So you begin to wonder just who's keeping the correct records or not.
Now, I don't dwell on that too long, because you know it's a difficult subject because people don't know now.
Yeah.
Now, so would it be fair to say, you know, on one of these missions, the Germans in the First World War had been fighting the defensive battle for most of the war, and they had a basic rule that it wasn't worth getting shot down because you were outnumbered 4-1, so unless you shot down four in that afternoon's work, it wasn't worth you being shot down. So was there any element of, I mean, that was the German way of doing it, was to avoid trouble where you couldn't sort of, in almost a good chance of surviving. Did you bear in mind that when you went into action like that? Was there a feeling that you mustn't get shot down because that would just make the situation worse?
No, I don't think so. I think the heat of the moment, I had no great hate against the Germans, none whatsoever at that stage. We sort of came out of Kiwi land, and we really didn't know Germans to any extent at all, other than what we'd read in books. But we had a respect for their ability as an enemy, but there was no great desire to kill. I think we only thought of the aircraft we destroyed. Very rarely did we think of the life inside. And I know I can always recall the first time I actually watched a plane shot down by me that actually spiraled down and went into a yard right in front of a church and the whole thing, but that gave me such a shock when I saw the destruction just in a split second that I suddenly sort of realised that the first time, because I had momentarily seen him in the cockpit previously, I had actually shot over the top and seen him slumped in the cockpit, and I suddenly realised there was a life there. And probably something I never thought of much before.
Did it worry you much? I mean, or would you sort of snap?
I can still see it. I still remember it. It didn't worry me. Because we were losing our own as well.
Now, were you nervous? It's something I should have perhaps asked before takeoff. When you got the thing that there's a lot coming and you have to go and deal with them.
I think we all had different effects. My hands perspired every time. At the moment there was a same when we were Biggin Hill and we used to go into preparing for sweeps and so on. It's the same thing. I'd start to look, my hands would start softening, and it didn't matter what I did with the damn thing. That was the way my nerves showed. I couldn't stop my hands sweating. But other people, I think, got different ones. And of course, usually, invariably, your bladder told you to go for a walk as well. That was all part of the nerves. But once you're in the cockpit and once you started, your nerves went.
You just got on with it.
You were just a flying machine then.
What about at night, you know, or during rest periods? I mean, did you sort of start getting edgy then?
No, we didn't. I don't recall many of us. I think perhaps the odd one did. The ones usually that were ready to break down. It was a strain. But in Malta, if you're reverting back to that battle...
Oh, yes, yes.
Because there we got night bombing all the time, and as you know, there was more bombs dropped over Malta than Greater London.
I'll come back to that.
And so actually, we refused to get up for any air raids. They just let the air raids go. We just went into our beds, and we could hear the bombs falling outside. And even when one 250-pound went straight through our bedroom, crashed through the floor, that's the only time we had to get up in a bit of a panic.
Now, getting back to this typical raid, because I've taken the bitter side of the first. So you've dived down, you've broken up the formation, you carry on diving in a straight line, and then...
Well, you've got enough speed then. You know you're in safe because you've got maximum speed. That's the time to pull up, yes.
Now, the intent then would be to zoom back up and look for a straggler of the broken formation.
Or get height for safety, yes, at that time.
So the first priority was regaining height.
Yeah.
And then looking for stragglers or from the formation, or would you go on to the next formation?
If you're number two is still with you, well, you might look for formation. If you're on your own, you look for stragglers.
And would you by then, would they often pursue you?
Oh, yes. And, of course, sometimes they would be following around the streets of Malta. You'd get right down that low. And because the moment you started to tightly turn, they had to give up because they couldn't turn as well as you did. And that was our main escape. If we got followed down by not usually one, but by a formation of fighters, and you were on your own, because that's when they suddenly got you by yourself. Virtually the streets of Malta were your safety. In other words, the lower you could get down, the better.
So low level evasion tactics, and
yes.
That's against the ME-109 particularly.
Yeah. The one or two, we managed to destroy them that way because the silly things tried to follow and crashed in.
They just couldn't do it.
They couldn't turn as tight as we could, no. But there we learned a sharp lesson, or I did once. We struck a lonely Italian, and I had an Australian with me, and he was on his way back towards Sicily, and I attacked him. And he damn near shot me down. He was so good a pilot. First time I'd ever struck. He probably one of the old Italian aerobatic display pilots before the war, I think I struck, because he could fly. And he practically outmaneuvered me as every facet. And he was flying a Reggiani aircraft. And at that time they had Daimler Benz engines in them, and their performance was nearly as close as, just about as good as the Spitfire. And you had to be very careful with this chap that I struck. And I admired him, because I had my Australian, so there was two of us against him. And I'd run out of cannon fire, and so I asked the Aussie to have a go at him. And he had a go, and he nearly got shot down by him. And then I called him, I said, look, we're getting too far away, we're getting towards Sicily, let's leave him go. And he was smoking. And we turned to go back to Malta, and I always remember he turned round and attacked and started to follow us back, and I thought, Mr. Italian, I admire you. We'd always had a sort of a relative contempt for the Italian, but oh boy, this fellow was good.
So he'd, two against one, he was in an aircraft roughly comparable, but he was better.
To think he was willing enough to turn around and have a go at us, I thought that was quite incredible.
And now, any other particular instance you recall from those, you know, those endless flights of combat over Malta?
Yes, there was one particular that we had, which we'd been annoyed for a long time. It was coming reverting back to Italians. They had a big bomber called Kent 1007Z.
A what?
A Kent, C-A-N-T, then 1007, and then a Z. They were a three-engine bomber, and they were really using the same tactics that the Fortress Americans came in with well before that. In other words, they flew tight formation, and they carried... relatively small bomb carried, but they carried umpty-one machine guns as defense, so that when they were flying, they were virtually fortresses. And in formation of three, if you tried to attack them, they had a good chance of shooting you down. They were very powerful in it, and they used to send over formation of three or five over Malta at usually pretty high, around about 25,000 feet up, with somewhere around about 50 to 60 fighters around them, just stooging along. And of course, it was purely more of a propaganda movement. It used to annoy the hell out of the Maltese to see these great bombers just arrogantly stooge across and drop these relatively small bombs, but as if to say, see, we've got utter contempt for you, and we couldn't get at them. And anyhow, one day we did scramble pretty early. Old Woody had taken us off early, and I had one Australian with me, and we climbed up Zeppelin by pure coincidence. When I got up to around about 30,000 feet, bingo, there were our other two formations from our same squadron, with Laddie Lucas and leading. And we first, one of those rare times when we were up at about 30,000 feet and saw the whole formation of the enemy aircraft all below us, the whole lot. It was, must have been somewhere 60 or more 109s, plus masses of Reggianis and Mackies, and then these three big bombers sitting in the middle of it. Just impregnable. It looked impossible. And old Laddie said, let's have a go at them, fellas. He said, I'll lead the first formation down, and he said, I'll go for the left-hand side one. And he told Raoul Dadalangli, was the other chap, and he said, you take the right one, and Jack, you cover our tails, and if you've got a chance, have a go at the leader. And it was quite incredible. He went down, and we attacked at such speed that the fighters didn't have time to react. It was quite amazing. And I saw the first one going down. Well, by that time, I'd started to follow down. And then I saw the right one going down in flames, and mine was left. And so we put it down in flames. That was the three of them destroyed. It was quite immaculate, just perfect. And, of course, Laddie Lucas was thrilled, because Laddie was, it was not long before that he became CO of the squadron, and that was quite a triumph for him. It was a darn good operation he did.
Can we talk a little about the accuracy of gunfire? You know, because shooting, I mean, some people would say it's more important to be a good shot than to be a good pilot. Some people would say the opposite as well. But I mean, how difficult was shooting? What about deflection shooting?
Deflection shooting was a science that we quite often forgot, and we just went in close. But you had to remember that your guns and the Spitfire were harmonized from outside your propellers to a focal point 300 yards away with us, as the way it was set. And you must remember that they were harmonized, and there was a cannon drop. In other words, your shells dropped, I think it was from memory, somewhere around about 12 feet at 300 yards. It's quite a big drop with cannon shell. So they harmonized up, and your machine guns were harmonized. Your 303s had a slightly different droppage, so to meet at that focal point 300 yards away. Well, when you were in a steep turn, you must remember that now all your harmonizing is different, because you are now over allowing in your gun. So you had to have a mental picture of the actual traction of your shells. And if you go to an extreme, if you happen to be upside down at that time, you're completely wrong. You've got no allowance for cannon drop, and you'd have to be laying high. In other words, deflection shooting was quite to do it accurately, it required quite a lot of calculation. But in the heat of the battles that we were involved in most of the time, it was a case of getting in close, and so it didn't get as critical. But at that 300-yard operation, you had to literally track your line of flight and get the right deflection.
Now, what range would you shoot at? That's 300 yards.
300 yards was your perfect one.
That was best, wasn't
it? But anything closer was good, too. Anything further out, and the chances are you weren't going to get it.
I'm just wondering if you sometimes go closer, but there wasn't a question of harmonising closer than that. That would be...
No, that's just close-range shooting, yes. Yep, now close-range shooting, that's all. And the...
Do you think you were a natural shot, or did you get better, or...?
I don't think I was a particularly good shot. Well, I like to think I was at the time, I guess, but I don't think I was a superb shot, because in the heat of the moment, you almost forget your calculations. You know, but I think you're doing it automatically, perhaps. It comes back to good flying, a lot of it. If you're slamming on a lot of rudder and you're skidding like hell, your shells are not going to go very accurately either, are they? So you've got to do perfect flying as well.
And were you very conscious of the length of burst? People who just watch war films think you can just fire as much as you like, but you can't, can you?
No, you're just wasting your shell ammunition, really.
How long would a burst be?
2 second burst would probably be about usually the most effective. That's a lot if you stop to think about it. That's quite a firing of shells.
And about how many 2-second bursts could you?
As many as you get a chance to. It mightn't be more than about a couple.
No, I mean, how long before you run out of ammunition? Because that would be more the thing, wouldn't it?
Oh, I've forgotten my mathematics on that one now.
You couldn't fire for that long, though.
No, 10 seconds of burst like that, I think, and you'd probably be starting to get low.
Was there anything else about? Would you normally try and come from under or above on the tail, I presume?
Yes.
Any preference between under and above? And you'd normally come from above, wouldn't you?
Yes, at fully astern, probably ideal. And slightly under is the way you usually do it, because you know that he's not going to see you quite as easily. That's what they did to us, anyway.
So what would happen? You've broken a format. You've done as much as you can. Now suddenly you're on your own. You're not in the two anymore, or you've run out of ammunition. What's the next thing on the mission? It's getting home, isn't it? But I mean, how? Tell me about that.
Are you talking about from France or from Malta?
No, this is Malta.
Malta.
So you've not got far to go, I presume.
Well, we had some little rocks. Funny enough, there was a... I'm trying to think of the name of the rock now. I can't think of the name of the point. Bonta Point, I think. I've lost the name. But if you're on your own, the first thing to do is to try and find a mate, if there was one. And so we usually dive straight down to this particular point in Malta, hoping that maybe another chap was there. If he was, then you were back as a pair and you were a striking force again. Otherwise, you had to watch, because you must remember that the Luftwaffe, if they've spotted you, they're down in a formation at you and you're trapped. Then you're fighting for your life, just flying around literally on the streets of Malta, because you've just got no show of getting at them. But if you've got someone with you, you're a totally more powerful force. But invariably, you finished up on your own.
And so you'd basically just... Where would you go? Back to the airfield?
Back to the airfield.
As quick as possible.
Yeah, and then of course, there was usually another wave of fighters came in that tried to stop your landing. That was... Then things got a bit difficult. And
now, how do you land? I mean, I can't quite understand how you did it. How did you try and land when people are shooting at
you? Well, you didn't. You actually... The aerodrome had self-defense with Beaufort guns around them, and of course you put your wheels and flaps down and you'd ease in, and you'd know that you're likely to be getting shot at, and if suddenly there was a fire of Beaufort shells pouring past you, firing at the 109 behind, that was also warning you, and your wheels are up and you're out and you don't attempt to land, and so you have to do another circuit and have another go at it. You might have three or four shots at that before the 109s give up the idea of trying to get at you. We depended a lot on those, on our ground defence at that point.
What about the anti-aircraft defences generally? I mean, they can get in your way as well as everything. Yeah, I mean, they're just firing off. I mean, what about them?
They were magnificent. We just took a chance with them.
So you ignored them?
Yep. We just flew into the flak quite often and just hoped for the best. They didn't hit us, that's all.
Were they firing barrages or aimed? You know, where they just put up a massive...
They're mostly just giant barrages, yes. But when the Ju-88s came down at formation, hard into the drones, then they were being fired at.
Now, what would the procedure be when you actually landed and you were able to land? You'd land and then... Would you taxi it to the pen, or what would happen?
You try and taxi the pen. I came to one stage where I had to just jump out of the aircraft and let it keep on running because it was getting fired at. But that was a rare case. No, usually you just whip it into the nearest pen you can get and that's it.
And you taxi in?
Yes. And don't forget that it's always had great admiration for the ground crew. They'd be out to meet you, and the poor devils, they'd been under shelter because the drone had just been blitzed and bombed just before, and they'd been no defence at all.
Now, what about the ground crew? Can you talk a bit about the job they did? Because there must have been a lot of holes in your aircraft from flying through shrapnel.
They just had to repair them. If they couldn't repair it, they'd take a wing off one and put it on another. They'd work right through the night, of course, sometimes, to get aircraft serviceable. At times, there was a short period when we actually had chaps that went into the control office with Woody and pretended they were flying because there was no aircraft serviceable. That was a bad period in Malta. And
explain that a bit more for them, because I don't think they'll fit. You mean they...
There were no aircraft serviceable. But old Woody used to pretend that some had scrambled. And of course, the Y service in Germany are listening to this and thinking that we've got about 12 airborne and there was not one on the air. But some of the chaps would be sitting into the control office pretending they were flying and also attacking the formations. And you'd be surprised how many of our fellows got shot down those days too, according to the German claims. But that was only very rare occasions when we got that bad. But the poor ground crew, they were struggling.
And what about the... So what would you do when you weren't flying? I mean, how long would it be, once you've got down, how long would it be before your next mission might be? Would it just be the next scramble or...?
Yep, it was so difficult of transport of getting down to our drone, we had to walk down and carry our gear most of the time. And we weren't that... wasn't too far to walk, but we used to walk down just before dawn in the dark, trying to dodge all the little personnel bombs which had been dropped overnight, and get down to the drone and sit. And we would do half a day. They found having shorter changes in the squadron, it was too much effort getting there, so we actually took half a day each, one flight to take on. I'm talking about when we were relatively short of aircraft. And so we'd spend either a dawn till midday or a midday to dusk shift.
And that, how many times might you be scrambled in that? I mean,
Might be two or three.
An average flight's about an hour, isn't it? There's an average flight about
an hour. Yes, and sometimes less. It's surprising how many were only about 45, 50 minutes.
And so you could be up to... Three times would be a lot.
Yeah.
In the morning.
Yes, you'd be working hard. I can give you a wee extract out of my logbook if you want to see what it looks like.
I'll perhaps take a photocopy of it and sort that
so
out.
So it gives you a picture of what we do.
Now, any other particular events you remember or contacts during that period? Are there any sort of stories you particularly remember from either in that time at Malta?
I could give a picture of a different sort of courage that I admired. There was a New Zealander that came in to Malta. He was a particularly nice guy, but he had no experience of flying. He should never have arrived there, but he came with it, and he was stuck with it. And he came with a big wave at the time when we had a fair number of spits. But however, his first attack that he was caught with was attacking a wave of Luftwaffe straight over Grand Harbour through our own flak. And he dived after JU-87 dive bombers. He was into those. They'd been silly enough to send some of them over. And he got hit by our own flak. You were talking about our flak. And he was driving through our flak, and he got hit, poor man. And so he bailed out. And anyhow, he was a courageous man. So a couple of days later, he was up again, and he went into this flak again, and he attacked. You wouldn't believe it. The poor man got shot down again with our own flak. And then a third time later on, he was up fighting again, and he got, once again, I can't remember whether it was flak or 109 that got him this time, but we got out from our drone and were watching this attack and saw this poor Spitfire coming down with its wings wobbling and looking terribly dangerous and only half a rudder left, and he started to make towards Tukali to land, and we thought, my shattered nerves, he doesn't think he's going to land that thing, does he? And he kept losing height, and the nearer he got the drone, we thought he's mad. And then we saw flaps go down, and he put his wheels down, and I thought, he's crazy. And he tried to turn to go into the drone, and he was unable to turn. He had no rudder left practically, so he just went through, crashed into the rocks. And of course it just went up in a puff of smoke, and so we rushed over to this aircraft to see what had happened to this poor man. We expected to find a body, and what we heard was, get me out of this bee thing. From underneath, we dragged this poor man out, and would you believe, his parachute, we kept on telling him to bail out, his parachute, which was full of shells, if he jumped out, would never have opened. And that man actually lived and came back to New Zealand and lived a normal life. Quite incredible. I admired that man's courage. We said to him, "What the devil? Why didn't you jump out?" He said, "I was sick of bailing out." Poor man, that was his life in Malta.
What would you do? I mean, was there any time for recreation? You know, this old picture of going for a drink, or was that all kiboshed by the shortage of everything?
Lovely place to swim because you only had 6-inch variation of tide, and the water was warm. It comes back to my sort of complex of sergeants versus officers over that period, of course, that the officers used to go for their recreation across to the island of Goza, and they had recreation spots. We didn't have that.
I thought you had been...
No, when I was an officer, we were too busy flying. I never got it then. So I never got to Goza, but I believe it was very nice there.
What are the any recreations? No bars, I presume?
No. They're local plonk. Sort of wine that we called it used to give an awful headache.
But you didn't drink much, did you?
No, not that period.
And anything else about? I don't want to repeat the material in the book too much, but I mean the book's very good on Malta. Mm. Any other stories that you particularly remember from Malta? Just that you recall.
Not just off the top of my head, I don't think.
Did you have any idea of this, of how many claims you've made? I mean, I know that you don't know what you shot down at the cabin. It's almost impossible now to say. But in your own mind, how many did you think you shot down at the cabin?
I think it was around about six or seven.
Were you aware of the definition of an ace? An ace is five.
No, I never heard about that till later, this figure five business. I hadn't heard about it. Had a little bit of a battle over the title of that book that you were talking about there, because I didn't particularly like the tucking on the last bit of the ace, because I never sort of classified myself as one of those. But they stick to this figure of five. If you shut down five, they say you're an ace. Well, that's what we've got to live with.
So what happens next then in your travel? I mean, how long was your tour of duty then?
It was about 6 months. Actually, I left in June, so we arrived in April. That's April, May, June, July, August. No, August the 4th I left. Just about 6 months, wasn't it?
Why were you down to leave then?
The main reason I left then really is because my leg wasn't healing.
Was that because of the diet?
Yes, the diet mainly, I think. It was still pretty poor rations. They were improving, but I think that was the main reason.
And what were the symptoms? I mean, was it
just festering sort of a wound?
So how did you leave?
Flew off in a Hudson late and dark at night. Many of us were offered to go out in submarines, and not one fighter pilot wanted to go that way out. We reckoned that was a damn dangerous thing to do.
So which route?
To Gibraltar.
Anything about the flight, or?
Not on our particular flight. The next flight of Hudson took out half the squadron were killed. They crashed in Gibraltar. And actually, Screwball Byrne was one of the lucky few that got out of it. A couple of my best friends that flew with me, including my Australian friend, they all swam in Gibraltar. It was quite a dangerous room to land in. It was quite a narrow landing capacity in Gibraltar, not easy for heavily laden aircraft.
But in your case, you made it.
Yep, no problems.